Hello, my name's George Rutherglen. I'm on the law faculty here. I'll stand up because our microphones aren't working, and I want to make sure you hear everything I have to say. But I promise you, I will be brief. I'd like to welcome you to this panel on the compensation factor. We have distinguished panelists today, and I think they perform a function that we are especially proud of here at the University of Virginia Law School, which is to take the academic world, the world of theory, and try to see how it plays in the world of practice. So my colleague, George Geis, who is the John V. Ray Research Professor and the director of our program in law and business, has done much recent research on corporate law and its current global reach. He's here to fill us in on the current understanding of the law and economics of management compensation in corporate America today. We have William Carmichael, who is a graduate of the law school, chairman of the Columbia Funds, and has had a long career, mainly in business. He left his law practice behind many years ago. He serves on the boards of numerous companies, and he brings to us the valuable judgment and experience from his work with these major corporations. And then Walter Bardenwerfer, who's next to my left, he's the vice president and general counsel of Towers Watson, which is a professional consulting firm. He also serves as the director on several companies involved in the consulting business. I welcome their participation in this panel because they have immediate experience of the precise problems that have led to criticism of executive compensation, not just since the immediate financial crisis, but in the last several decades. And in fact, I found in preparing for our talk today a column now almost 10 years old by Paul Krugman, whom I regard as the orthodox voice of liberal opinion and outrage. And he said, commenting on a famous exchange between F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway, the rich are different from us. They have more money. He offered this observation. The explosion in CEO pay over the last 40 years is an amazing story in its own right, and an important one. But it is the only most recent spectacular indicator of a broader story. The reconcentration of income and wealth in the United States. The rich have always been different from you and me, but they are far more different now than they were not long ago. Indeed, they are as different now as they were when F. Scott Fitzgerald made his famous remark. And we see this in populist outrage over compensation on Wall Street, over compensation to higher levels of management. The question we'd like to address today is, what is the nature of the problem? What can be done about it? What are its broader social implications? I can assure you, we will not solve these problems in the 1 hour that we have allocated to this topic. But our aim is to get an informed analysis of this issue from the different perspectives that our panelists bring to us today. So I'll ask my colleague, George Geis, to begin with a discussion of the many papers that have been written on executive compensation, what can be done about it within the structure of corporate law, and then I'll invite Bill and Walter to comment on their views. From there, we will go on to what the nature of the solutions might be, which perhaps would be a discussion of proposals that did not work. But as one distinguished academic commentator said, on this issue, the devil is in the details. And then we would like to end with a discussion of what this says about broader trends in our society. At the close of each of these topics, I welcome your participation. I hope we hear from you, and I know you want to hear from our panelists. So, George, why don't you begin?
You know, George, I was actually thinking about this exact problem for the last 15, 20 years or so. And late last night, about 2 in the morning, I finally figured out the solution. So I was about to unveil it. Unfortunately, it's on PowerPoint, and now that our electricity has gone down, I can't pull up my PowerPoint slide with the exact solution to this problem. So I think we'll just have to wait a little bit longer. No, seriously, I think that if you look at the various commentary, I would describe it as three separate problems. And the way I think about it is that there's one problem that's been around for a very long time related to compensation, and then at least two, potential complicating factors that I think have emerged in the last decade. The long problem, I think, is just what's known in academia as the agency cost problem. Those of you in my corporations class will be quite familiar with this, which is just whenever you've got the right or the ability to spend someone else's money, you're not going to make the same decision that you would make if it was your own money. This has come out earlier today already. I think that's just a fundamental concern. I think that there are some benefits that our corporate system allows through centralization of resources and decision making that may offset some of those agency cost concerns. But fundamentally, there's just a misalignment of incentives that will typically take place whenever you're making decisions that involve someone else's money. I think that's been around for a long time. I think there are two more recent problems that may be complicating this agency cost problem even further. One is, again, a theme that was at least mentioned a little bit earlier on today, which is now are we facing a situation where it's not just decisions that are made at the firm level that are harming the ultimate owners of the firm, but to what extent is there a systematic risk, right? To what extent are we setting up a compensation structure that rewards people that take risks, they're going to have some sort of contagion that roll out and impact other institutions adversely, right? We saw a dramatic resistance and outcry to this over the last couple of years, but I think it would be interesting for the panel to explore some of the linkages between the current compensation system structure, why it's been put in place, but also what extent, if any, do we think that this has been responsible for some of these contagion concerns? And then I think finally, a third problem or complication that we see is the question of whether this is getting worse. Again, I think this relates to the quote that George opened the panel with, but just to give some simple numbers to it, one of the common measures of executive compensation and the magnitude of executive compensation is the level of CEO compensation to the average compensation of the workers. If you go back, 20 years ago and you looked at that ratio, right, how much were CEOs earning relative to the average compensation of their entire employee base, the number was about 140 times the employee base. Even if you go back, just 10 years ago, right, the number was had increased dramatically up to 500 times, just in a 10-year period. I don't have the number today, right? I'd be interested to know if it's gone up or down from there. My sense is it's continued to even go up. But I think even apart from this agency cost problem, even apart from this problem related to systemic risk, there's some questions about is this situation getting even more, is the gap even widening even further, right, between what top executives are getting paid and what other executives are getting paid. So, from a big picture point of view, I think those are three of the problems you're seeing. I think it's a very complicated issue to talk about, though, and I think that part of the complication stems from the fact that you do see these enormous paychecks that are going out, but the question is always, well, what are you getting for what you pay for what you're paying? I mean, one of the most famous executive compensation cases was a case involving Disney. Those of you, again, in my class, we've studied the Disney case, and Michael Ovitz was famously paid about $130 million all in over the year in what proved to be a disastrous decision for Disney's management, bringing in Ovitz as the number two to Michael Eisner. just a very complicated and difficult situation, and one that many of the Disney shareholders were very disappointed about. But it's interesting to note that on the day he was announced as being put in that position, Disney's stock rose 4.4%, increasing the market capitalization of the firm by over $1 billion. Right? Was that a bad decision to bring him in? Probably so, right? But a full understanding of what's happening there, I think, is important for us to really be able to get our arms around the whole notion of executives and executive compensation.
Walter, you see the problem the same way?
Well, I certainly see a problem. I believe that the problem with the rending of the social fabric is very real, and it's something that many of us are seeing in our families and all around us. If you travel around the world and go to places like India or the Philippines and some of the countries where the wealth disparity is just absolutely dramatic, you've got incredible billionaires in India that own entire industries, basically, and you have people that live literally on the street in gutters and stuff and have little fires to keep warm. People living in cardboard boxes on highways along the sides of the side streets in Manila and so forth, and people living behind gated communities. We're not there, but we're not headed in the right direction, in my personal opinion. And the reason I say that is not just the things that you see on the news, and you see the kind of CEOs I mentioned earlier sitting up in front of Congress saying they don't know anything about what happened and why they, you know, just about brought the whole economy down, but you see it right in your own family. Just a case study. And my case study is a very simple little one. I have a brother who is a lawyer, went to the University of Virginia as an undergraduate, went into land use planning as a career. It's actually a good legal career for those of you law students who might be thinking about what to do. He's out in Louisville, Kentucky, and it's a middle-class American city, middle-sized American city, extremely hard hit by this recession. But in the business my brother's in, he started a small law firm. It's still a small law firm, but he's probably the leading land use lawyer in Louisville. He watched as the economy came to a complete screeching halt. Now, we didn't see that in Washington, where I live. We saw, actually, in some respects, the opposite, because of all the government regulation and so forth, we saw a lot of activity. In fact, house prices are up in Washington. In Louisville, it's the totally opposite situation. Not one of his clients has built anything in the last 3 or 4 years. Many of them have gone bankrupt. All the vendors to these people have gone bankrupt. Employees have left these firms. They just can't employ them anymore. It impacts on things like my brother's law firm, where, you know, they can't afford, because they're not getting the fees from their developer clients anymore. They can't afford to keep the health coverage for their employees. They have to lay off people, et cetera, et cetera. What has that done to my brother, who's a capitalist as much as the rest of us here? It's given him the idea, as he visualizes what he sees in front of him every day in Louisville, in that community, and then he looks at what's going on television when he sees these CEOs paraded up there who have just about busted the entire economy. His view is, well, to me, his brother, well, you're the one capitalist that's probably okay, but the rest of them, the CEOs in this country, have brought this country to its knees, et cetera, et cetera. And this is an intelligent, educated person who's spent his life in the economy. And I listen to him talk like this, and I say, this is a broad feeling abroad in our country, and it is not a healthy one. And I think we get to the question of, well, what does compensation have to do with this? I think we have to start with the proposition that the country has a right to sort of two interests that may at first seem like they're a little bit in conflict. One is that we have a healthy, vibrant economy. And I think the other one is that we have a healthy social fabric. And I think the social fabric is under some strain. And I think some of the case studies that Ted's talked about, and some of the things we talked about a little bit earlier this morning, suggested that it is not impossible to have both, to have a healthy social fabric and to have a healthy economy. And frankly, to have a healthy economy, you're going to have to pay senior executives competitive wages and competitive opportunities in their overall compensation. My company actually is in the business. We're probably one of the biggest executive compensation consulting firms in the world, but that's actually a small part of our business. And I am not an executive compensation consultant. I really don't even know very much about the discipline of executive compensation consulting. But I will say that it is mainly a data-driven business, believe it or not. And one of the problems might be one of the things that we have tried so hard to do, and this might be getting to sort of what I think part of the theme of this compensation section is, we've been looking at perhaps the wrong things. One of the things we've been trying very hard to do is create additional transparency. So all this stuff we now put in our proxies and all these CDNAs that describe compensation for the top executives of companies have created, one, a mountain of data, but I don't know that it's necessarily good information. It's impenetrable in many ways, unless you're in the securities bar and you like reading this kind of stuff. But two, it's created, I think, a ratchet effect that the very publicity of all this transparent data, our CEO, for example, every conceivable thing he gets from his pension, he's been in the company for 30-some years, his pension, all the accruals of his pension that brought it to where it is today, his 401k plan, every conceivable possible angle on bonus stuff. We don't have a bunch of perks and airplanes and those kind of things, but the basic stuff, it's all there, and it'll be all there for our competitors, and it'll be all there for their competitors. It's all out there in the public record. It's gone over by executive comp consultants in excruciating detail, and they come to the comp committee of the board and they say, well, this is what the data shows. Your company has these revenues and these earnings, and it's this size, and here's what your peer companies are paying their guys, and this is what you ought to get for the earnings you contributed last year and so forth, and there's a little ratchet up. And then the next guy's comp committee meets 2 weeks later somewhere, and that new data is out there, and it ratchets back up again. So one question is, are we even focused on the right things? We're focused on transparency. We're focused on more disclosure. We're focused on this new thing called say on pay, where shareholders are supposed to vote whether they like, it's a non-binding vote, but whether they like their executive's pay package. They're supposed to vote on how often they get to vote on the pay package. And I just sit back and I ask myself, does any of that have anything to do with what we saw when we saw those CEOs of the investment banks and those CEOs of WorldCom and Enron and all those people sitting up in front of Congress with their ruined companies and the damage that they did to our country? Now, I'm not saying, let's pay everybody whatever they want, and let's, that's vitally important to our country that our CEOs make 500 times the average employee. I think it's exactly the opposite. I think that is damaging our social fabric a great deal. But I think we may have been focusing on a lot of the wrong issues. And after it's my turn again, I'll come back to some of the things that I think we might better have been focusing on or start focusing on.
How do you see the problem, Bill?
Well, I come at it a little different perspective. I've, in my career, I've worked with investment bankers. I've been out selling junk bonds, worked with hedge funds, private equity firms, been on comp committees. And I would have to tell you, I've never been asked to go on a comp committee by management. It's been the rest of the board members, because I challenge this because I have the same concerns Walter has. And I'm not as concerned about the social fabric. I agree it's a problem. My focus has been on the morale factor in an organization when there's too much at the top. I think it hurts performance, and you can see it starting to happen in the numbers. It starts to come down. You see more cheating on numbers. So I think there is an issue in comp. I've kind of separated my thoughts, though, into the financial crisis we've just gone through. Now, we've been through two bubbles in the last 10 years, Ponzi schemes, bailouts, and all that. But a lot of these issues are the same as they were 20 years ago. They're just getting a lot more attention. But I don't think it's really so much a compensation issue that's causing it there. It's really, we're not good at evaluating risk. And I blame not only management, but the boards, but we're making significant improvements on trying to evaluate risk and making sure we understand what we're getting into. But I separate on the financial crisis, things we did poorly, could do better. Chair of mutual funds, Bank of America had to write checks for $1.2 billion because our guys didn't think that credit crisis was there. And it was kind of sad. I had to meet with the portfolio manager that did this, and I just asked him, pick one of these structured investment vehicles that had mortgage-backed securities in it. He said, what's the capital structure? Because you say you've got senior debt. He didn't know the answer. The night before, I had gone online, just typed in on Google the name of that vehicle, got their capital structure, and realized we had senior debt, and they only had 3% below them. At that point, the issue there wasn't his compensation. His compensation was based 10% on one-year results, 60% on 3 years, and 30% on 5 years. It wasn't a compensation issue. It was a competence issue. And he lost his job because he didn't make good decisions on that. It had nothing to do with his compensation. Same thing, I've had two bankruptcies where I've been on the board, and because I was one of the few that didn't have conflicts being on special committees, there were good business reasons to take on that leverage. One was private equity company, and the shareholders really said, we're going to leverage up, pull this money out. We know it creates all this extra risk. But their business model that was discussed earlier is different from the public company model. Their business model is get as much money out of all these companies as they can. If two of them fail, they don't care as long as they make their hurdle rates. So that's part of, I think, what's wrong in the social fabric is that kind of mentality. We don't care if the two fail. And I actually was on a panel one time with a hedge fund guy who was talking about this, and I said, you know, that's great. Now, you help me with my letter to my shareholders. Gee, I hope you were smart enough to invest in the other eight. Sorry. You know, so I have a different role. I've got to take a stand against short-term shareholders. But as you had from Ted's examples this morning, there aren't any easy answers. But what I've seen on all this is there is a problem in executive comp, and the boards have to do a better job getting control over that. Does it create extra risk? I haven't seen the extra risk really created by the compensation programs. It's really just poor evaluation of risk or business models that drive you to have to take extra risk to be competitive. I guess we can go into the solutions a little later.
In a moment. So I just want to ask, George, suppose you found your PowerPoint slides and you found your solution to the agency cost problem, right? And magically it was put into place. I mean, would that solve the problem of unequal compensation as it's been discussed in this panel?
Well, so I'm going to contradict myself and I guess say something that I hope some of the panelists disagree with. I don't think you can solve the agency cost problem using the law. I don't think it's solvable. I think it should be viewed as a cost of doing business. I think there are some things that you can do to make it better, and there are some things you can do to make it worse legally. And so, you know, there is a role for the law to play in trying to minimize the agency cost problem. But fundamentally, I think that in the eyes of the law, it should be viewed as a cost of doing business that should be traded off against other potential benefits, right? I mean, there are some benefits to centralizing management, to centralizing control. That needs to be offset against some of these costs. Now, that said, I don't want to suggest it is unsolvable. I think that there are some alternative forums, maybe, that we can think about using to solve this problem. Some of the notions of a culture, right, or something else outside of the law. But I just don't think you can legislate a solution, right, to the agency cost problem. I mean, what would that look like? You know, we could put a cap on compensation, right? No executive earns more than $200,000 ever, right? I mean, I don't think that's a solution that people are accepted, you know, are prepared to accept. I don't think that's necessarily a good solution. I do think there are some things that can be better and some things that can be worse from a process point of view. I mean, I think having a stronger board of directors, for example, is something that is desirable, right? I mean, ideally, we're really writing a contract, right? The contract is just between the top executives and the board of directors. If we've got a board of directors that can better serve, right, as the counterpart to that contract, well, then maybe we're going to have more confidence that this contract is a real, valid, good contract. You know, beyond that, I just don't think there's an easy answer, George, at least not in the eyes of the law. And so I was being facetious, right, obviously, when I mentioned a quick PowerPoint that was going to get to the root of this. I just don't think there is an answer. At least not in the law. Now, maybe in the, you know, in other cultural forums, there are some real interesting opportunities here. But I hope some of my panelists disagree.
So, Bill, why don't you just tell us a little bit about the solutions that have been tried and, you know, what's happened to options? You know, a few decades ago were thought to be the be-all and end-all of properly aligning management incentives.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot has been done either by legislation or by boards themselves becoming more proactive. When I first started getting on boards, the mentality was totally different. There was one guy on a board who said to me, I think the board agenda should just have two items. We start with a prayer, and then we vote on whether we keep the CEO. If we keep them, then there's nothing else to discuss. Well, that attitude is gone. Those people are no longer around. But, you know, we have now the independence requirements, which I think has been very important, particularly on compensation committee and audit committees. But some of the changes we've made also are, I've insisted, I chair audit committees, that we meet first to talk about quality of earnings. The management is not going to get their bonuses paid by the comp committee, and we have overlap in the committees, till we understand the quality of the earnings. Are we really making the numbers, or are you gaming the system? I think it's important that you do have ownership, and you're trying to align the ownership, management, and the board. And that's a difficult one, though. Again, no easy answers. But if you're going to solve the agency problem, you've got to get them aligned closer. And the way you do that is stock ownership and a requirement to hold it. Now, I have a personal belief that if I go on a board, any stock I get, I cannot sell until I leave that board. That's not easy to say, like young academics that may need that to sell it. Same thing with, I was on a board with, it was originally a founder-owned company and became public. But one of the things you have to be concerned about is if you have too much wealth in your own company stock, you become totally risk-averse as you get near retirement. So if you insist management keep everything, you may end up, your competitors are going to blow by you because you're just too risk averse. On the other hand, if you have too little, there was one board, CEO was removed. He was selling it as soon as he got it, so he had no long-term incentive, not aligned with shareholders. We should have gotten rid of him earlier, probably. So I view the comp issue there as the solution is the Goldilocks issue. It can't be too little, it can't be too much. It's just the right amount, and boards have to make that decision. And it's not an easy decision. You're going to guess wrong sometimes. I think one of the good things that was passed, the clawbacks. If you end up, that find out that there were real issues, you're going to end up having to pay money back, legally enforceable. Now, again, tough decisions. A few years ago, the SEC changed the rules on lease accounting. Retailers had to restate. The old accounting was not bad. But they just viewed it differently. They viewed it instead of following the contractual terms on the lease, it was sort of what was the intent. Same thing, options. That was changed because of political pressure and Warren Buffett. I personally think they came up with the wrong answer. The old way actually mirrored the economic effects of the transaction. And the new ones don't. They reflect the intent. One bankruptcy, I think the company had booked like 45 to 50 million over a few years on option grants that were never exercised. So some of these things just don't work, but we're trying to get a lot of these things to improve the decision making. Every board now is putting in enterprise risk management. So the boards are now starting to understand the risks better, but more importantly, we're never going to know as much as management. The process itself is forcing management to do a better evaluation of the risk. I think one of the important things, though, is when you try to tie all this in with the ethics, you know, you can really lecture people on ethics, but you can't really get them to be ethical. And I think it was Bill Crutchfield kind of hinted at the fact that you can't legislate honesty and integrity, particularly when your legislators don't seem to have it. Well, some other things we're doing on board. One of the things I'm pushing for, and I haven't been successful anywhere, is I think each board should have the same requirement now that management has, sort of 360 reviews. Each board member should be reviewed by the other board members and also maybe by management. Nobody's been receptive to that, really. But as chair of Columbia Funds, one of the things I said was every other year, our council is going to do it on a no-name basis, so I get feedback to try to make me a better director. I'd like to see more of that done. I do think we need to, on boards, think about the skill set of compensation, human resources, the softer side of things. It's the boards have tended to be CEOs or retired CEOs or, because of Sarbanes-Oxley, financial people who tend to quantify everything and get more into qualifying things based on metrics rather than the softer skills. I talked about the stock ownership. I think that's been very important. Some other thoughts on the compensation thing, on the particularly as it relates to equality. One of the things we've done, and I wasn't even on the comp committee, but I suggested this, that it's a small company and not that profitable, but very low margins, but said, you know, how much is the CEO making versus what the rest of the management team and the shareholders are making? That was a pretty high number. When he was hit with that, it changed his viewpoint. He was looking at the metrics that we've always looked at. Peer group, you know, Garrison Keillor, everybody's above average. Everybody wants to have their guy in the 75th percentile. But one of the things we're also doing there is, you got your peer group in the proxy. Why don't you compare your stock price, your performance, whether you use EBITDA or earnings per share, get that metric, and maybe if you're in the 25th percentile there, then your CEO should be in the 25th percentile in the comp. So these are some of the ideas we're exploring, but I don't think this will solve the agency issue, but I think the boards are starting to get closer to the alignment with shareholders. Now, the other point I would make on the agency issue is, the articles written by professors, except one from Virginia Law School, I believe it was, tend to talk about shareholders as one group, and they aren't. I've got to represent a group of shareholders, some of which are very short-term thinkers. So if I'm on the board of a company that had five hedge fund owners, thinking long-term isn't going to work. I've got a responsibility under Delaware law to watch out for shareholders, not other constituents. Now, I am sort of blessed. One board I was on was domiciled, incorporated in Wisconsin, another one in Indiana. Their law does permit you to take into account other constituents in your decision-making. So I feel better about social fabric, things like that, under that state law. It'd be wonderful Delaware change. Now, the trade-offs, of course, are I'm under Indiana law or Wisconsin law, and there's no case law. So you don't have the certainty that you would like as a board member or management. But so those are some of the things I think are improvements we're making, but agree we won't ever solve the problem, but we're trying to narrow it.
Coincidentally, we've got the Chief Justice from the Delaware Supreme Court visiting later this afternoon. So if you want to spend some time lobbying him, you know, we'll probably arrange that.
Actually, I have to tell you an interesting story. Well, Charles Elson, who is a UVA law grad, and he had me on a panel on backdating options out in the Weinstein Center on Corporate Governance. And I think it was Strine or Chandler, I can't remember which one was there, and backdating options. He said, all these cases are going to come before me, and I want to make it clear to all you lawyers out there that because you're showing me something that's statistically impossible to happen, that isn't going to be good enough, because in this morning's paper I read that some woman won the lottery and the odds were 280 million to one, so you people would conclude statistically she cheated.
Walter, do you have something to say about the solutions?
Yeah, I guess I would disappoint George by saying I probably agree with him on the law point. I'm just going to read something real quickly here, which I think makes the point. I think Congress has often just ignored the law of unintended consequences because the political pressure is so great to do something, say something, set some examples, you know, create an image. And we look at this whole issue of compensation. I just read in last Tuesday's Wall Street Journal, in the 1980s, Congress passed special excise tax for executives receiving big payments after a corporate takeover. Soon after, the tax gross-up was born, which companies footed the tax bill, putting the burden back on the shareholders, costing tens of millions of dollars to shareholders. Last decade, a new law mandating disclosure of financial officer salaries had the odd effect of raising financial officer salaries. Rival CFOs now had perfect information on their peers' pay, information that they didn't have before, and they wanted more. And another unintended consequence of the whole process of regulating the banks, which is going on now, quote, "Meanwhile, bankers and traders are continuing an exodus to boutiques and hedge funds, largely out of the government's purview." So, and I'm not suggesting that any of these specific steps were particularly wrong or that they didn't have some good consequences. But what I'm suggesting is, to George's point earlier, it seems awfully facile to get up there and say, well, let's legislate pay. Let's legislate more disclosure of pay. Let's legislate this and legislate that. And often it's done with very little consideration of the unintended consequences. Because once Congress has passed the law, everyone can say, I introduced that act, I voted for that thing, I did this, I did that, I got Sarbanes-Oxley or whatever it is, and go on to the next subject. It leads me to believe that there are significant limitations on what we can do legislatively to address these kind of problems. And I would tend to agree with Bill that the focus has to be on the management and the board of directors. I think the last panel talked here a little bit about humility. I think Ted was talking about the tendency to become arrogant, the tendency to believe you're infallible and so forth. You know, maybe there's some cultural norm that ought to be introduced, obviously not by a law, but where CEOs have to go out and have some kind of humility training once every couple of years, you know, be sort of stripped down to their raw essence and realize.
I thought that was the purpose of shareholder meetings.
Well, yeah, right. Where they learn what they don't know, and they learn to the fact that they need to oversee their companies and actually know what's going on in their companies and recognize the limitations of what they can do. And my last comment on this, on the solution point, again, is focused on the board of directors, is it was shocking to me during the whole financial crisis situation of how much just ignorance of what these companies were up to and what kind of financial transactions and financial engineering was going on, and how openly a lot of the senior management and directors said, we didn't know, we didn't understand. That was part of financial products division. We didn't really know what was going on over there. And you ask yourself the question, well, what are these people on the board for, and where did they come from, and what kind of questions are they asking, and what are their competencies, and perhaps are they so close to the CEO, even despite the changes in independence, which are definitely an improvement, they are, in fact, dependent a lot on the CEO to be on the board in the first place, and that being on a board is a wonderful thing to be. They set the pay of the executives. The executives have input on the pay of the board. And ultimately, you know, do they really want to ask those tough questions? Is why is the financial products division making such stupendous profits right now? Is there anything about the risk of that business that we should be concerned about? All of a sudden, a lot of people seem to not know anything about what was going on. So you ask yourself a lot of questions about the composition of boards, the number of boards that people sit on, the way the boards act, the willingness to ask tough questions, how much they actually understand about the business that they're overseeing. I defer to Bill, who's had a lot more experience with boards than I have, but my general sense is that might be a more productive place to put some of our attention than just trying to create some sort of legal structures.